It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has operated with 8 instead of 9 justices for over a year now since the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. That may change soon if Judge Neil Gorsuch is confirmed to the High Court, and that could come within a matter of days. This hour, we're going to be discussing that confirmation a little bit through a legal perspective. We're talking with Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa, where he's the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law, and Tony Goggin, Professor of Law at Drake University. Todd, Tony, welcome back to our program.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ben.
We wanted to talk, as I said, a little bit about Gorsuch's nomination, perhaps confirmation coming within a few days to start off our program. And then you brought up a number of interesting cases, primarily before the U.S. Supreme Court. We always like to hear the stories behind the cases and how they may set precedents here. We'll do that a little bit later in the hour. If you have any questions about the Gorsuch nomination or about any of the cases we discuss this hour, please feel free to join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, earlier this week, it was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announcing that Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed. He seems very confident, perhaps as soon as next Friday, and he dismissed the Democratic efforts to block the nominee, knowing that the GOP can use what has been oft-termed the nuclear option to get past the Democrats' filibuster if needed. And the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, has said indeed that they will filibuster this nominee. Aside from the politics, let's talk a little bit about Neil Gorsuch. Todd, let me start with you. What are the key points about Neil Gorsuch and his approach to court decisions that you think are most important to know?
Well, he's has a reputation as a conservative, and he's young. I think those are probably the two most significant things. He's going to be there a long time, health permitting, and he's a conservative judge. There are differences between judges on in not all cases, but in some cases, and it's fair to describe their tendencies in this way. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about some examples. But when you chart voting records and so forth and try to kind of map where he is, he's clearly conservative, and his pedigree is conservative. He worked in the Bush administration, in the Department of Justice. He clerked for Judge David Sentell, who's a conservative judge on the D.C. Circuit. He's involved with the Federalist Society, conservative organization. And so we describe him in that way. And so we can make some generalizations about the kind of judge that he'll be. But of course, they're just generalizations, and they can always surprise once they're in office.
Mm-hmm. So you said you can point to examples of what defines him as conservative. Give us an example where you would say this is clearly in his past as a decision that points
well,
to a conservative.
You know, the so-called case of the frozen trucker, which sounds like an old mystery novel or something written half a century ago, but that case has gotten a lot of play, and that illustrates conservatism in a couple of different ways. What was at issue in the case involved, as many of your listeners will know, a truck driver who's driving on the tollway, I-88 in Illinois, which mm-hmm. connects us to Chicago. And it's late at night. He can't find gas, so he pulls over. It's very, very cold. Once he kind of gets his bearings, he tries to pull back out on the highway. He discovers that the brakes are locked up on the rig that he's pulling. And so he calls for help, and it's freezing, and a lot of time passes. And he kind of dozes off. His phone rings, wakes him up. He's kind of going numb, so he's worried. So he calls, asks for help again. They say, just hang on. So his bosses are telling him, sit tight, help is on the way. He gets to a point where he doesn't think he ought to stay there anymore, so he unhitches his cab from the trailer, okay, drives away, and then help comes. He goes back and meets. Well, he's ultimately fired, and he's fired for abandoning the cargo that he was pulling. And there's a federal statute that says that if you refuse to operate your vehicle, and that's the important language in the federal law, if you refuse to operate your vehicle because of safety concerns about yourself or the public, you can't be fired for that refusal. Okay, so you can imagine a typical situation. A boss is telling the employee, get in that car and drive. And then you say, well, the brakes don't work. And no, get in that car and drive.
I'm not going to do it. It's too icy. I can't go
sure.
out there. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
I'll end it in the ditch.
It's not safe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he claimed the protection of that statute and said, the Department of Labor looked at the case and agreed with the trucker that he was entitled to the protection of the statute. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals panel on which Judge Gorsuch sat looked at it. And a majority of that panel, they sit in groups of three. Two of the judges agreed that the trucker was entitled to this. One of the hallmarks of judicial conservatives is when you're looking at the text either of the Constitution or of a statute, you really attend carefully to the text and you don't enforce anymore. We don't read between the lines as what do the words say.
Mm-hmm.
And what the words say is if you refuse to operate. And Judge Gorsuch said, well, he wasn't refusing to operate his truck. In fact, he operated it. He unhitched and drove away. He didn't refuse to drive it in a way that he was being ordered to drive it. And that's unfortunate for the trucker. But if it's up to Congress to say what the law is, we're not – even though, you know, our general sense of justice or fairness or something might indicate that, you know, we have to rule for the trucker, that's not the role of a judge.
Mm-hmm. And someone who had a less conservative view might – take the tact and say, well, we want to figure on common sense here and read a little bit between the lines of the text?
A bit. You know, what was Congress intending? What,
yeah.
You know, generally, what goals did Congress have in mind? And does this situation seem to fall within the area of concern that Congress had in mind? And if they didn't put it exactly that way in the statute, we're still going to try to vindicate what we understand the larger congressional goal to be. So that's one feature of conservatives. Just real quickly, I'll say, too, the Department of Labor in that case had sided with the trucker. And another feature of conservatives is they're frequently skeptical about what we call the administrative state, all those acronyms that are in our lives through the federal government, the IRS and the EEOC and the Department of Labor mm-hmm. and the EPA. All of those agencies have a lot of power. They have the power to write rules, and they usually have the power to decide cases as well. And a lot of conservatives are skeptical about that, about what the degree to which the Constitution permits these unelected federal agency bureaucrats, which I'll try to say in a neutral sense, to make rules that we have to follow and to decide cases. And it's also a way by which the federal government becomes very large is through this bureaucracy. And so there's some skepticism about those agencies there too.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about Tony Goggin, give us something else about this nominee that you gleaned perhaps from the hearings or from looking at his past.
Sure, Ben. One thing I would add to Todd's analysis, which I definitely agree with, is the fact that Justice Scalia, who is who Judge Gorsuch will be replacing if he's confirmed next week, Justice Scalia tended to support this doctrine that we call Chevron deference, in which it instructs trial judges to defer to the administrative agency's interpretation of statutes where there's some sort of ambiguity in the statute. So that is one of the most prominent differences between Gorsuch and Scalia. And in that sense, it suggests that Gorsuch is actually somewhat more conservative than Scalia, at least in terms of administrative law.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about Gorsuch I think is really interesting is the fact that he's from Colorado. And he's spent most of his career as a judge on the Tenth Circuit and grew up in Colorado. And President Trump made clear that he wanted justices who came from other parts of the country than the Northeast. He made that pledge during the presidential campaign. And so the fact that his first nominee is from Colorado and not from Washington, D.C. or New York could be an indication of where future Trump appointments may come from if there are future retirements on the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think that component of Gorsuch's biography is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. To the point of the politics of the court and the degree to which a justice is conservative or more liberal, I wanted to play a short clip. This is Chuck Schumer during the hearings we had just a few days ago in his floor speech. Chuck Schumer, this isn't a floor speech, he's saying Gorsuch repeatedly said during his hearings that there are no Republican judges or Democratic judges, to which Chuck Schumer said,
but if that were true, we wouldn't be here, would we? If that were true, if the Senate were merely evaluating a nominee based on his or her qualifications, Merrick Garland would be seated on the Supreme Court right now.
Okay, so, Tony, perhaps you can help us out there. How would you differentiate Neil Gorsuch from a Merrick Garland who was not given a hearing, not to mention not given a vote last year, the nominee of President Obama?
Right. Well, I certainly think that Gorsuch will likely be a more conservative justice than Merrick Garland would have been, just by looking at their rulings and looking at their background, as Todd indicated. In general, Merrick Garland was viewed as a moderate liberal, and Gorsuch is viewed as a textualist conservative, which, as Todd indicated before, means he focuses on the ordinary meaning of the words in the statutes and in the Constitution as of the time that the statute was enacted or as of the time the constitutional provision was adopted. And so that's definitely an interpretive approach that puts Gorsuch well within the conservative judicial philosophy. So I do think the fact that Neil Gorsuch will be serving on the Supreme Court and not Merrick Garland is an indication that we're going to end up with a more conservative court than we would have had Garland been confirmed last year.
Let me ask you this, Todd. What is the track record of justices ruling on decisions the way they were expected to before they were given a lifetime appointment to the high court? You know what I mean? They have a track record in lower courts up to the point that they are appointed. Are there any big surprises in our recent past where the justice just acted much differently or somewhat differently once he was on the high court, he or she?
Looking at the court right now, the justices on the court, I think Chief Justice Roberts himself stands out as probably the most recent example. He is certainly conservative. He's not as conservative by many measures as Justice Alito is, George W. Bush's other appointee. But he has surprised and I'd say disappointed conservatives, disappointed Republicans sometimes. Looking at the Obamacare case when it was up in front of the court, it was by virtue of Chief Justice Roberts' vote that the individual mandate, this requirement that you know, you either buy health insurance or you pay this penalty to the federal government. It was Chief Justice Roberts who found a way, found a legal theory to say that that was within Congress's powers. And a lot of people felt very betrayed by that. I think that's a nice example, too, of what Judge Gorsuch means when he says there aren't Democrat judges, there aren't Republican judges. I take what he means by that to be, you know, if we do indeed take a seat on the court, it's not our job just to line up with whatever the current political platform is of those parties. We may go against you from time to time. Having said that, when we talk about judicial theories, judicial philosophies, those theories and philosophies do push justices in different directions so that it's fair to talk about them in general ways as either being conservative or liberal.
Mm-hmm. The Democrats in the Senate have indicated they will filibuster Neil Gorsuch, which would make Mitch McConnell, he has promised to do this, employ the nuclear option, as it's been told. It's lowering the threshold from 60 votes to a simple majority in the Senate. This is already true of lower court appointees. Tony, how much do you think such a move would shape future choices and ultimately the conservative or liberal politics of the court?
Ben, I think it could have a big impact for this reason. As you say, if the Democrats filibuster Gorsuch, then McConnell will respond by employing the nuclear option and ending the filibuster. That would mean that if, say, Justice Kennedy were to retire in the next year or two and we have a new battle over a second appointment by President Trump, Trump would only need 51 votes to get his nominee approved. And that would likely incline him to choose a more conservative justice or a more conservative appointment, whereas when there's still a threat of a filibuster, it requires the president to choose a candidate who's capable of getting 60 votes. And so there are very significant ramifications to both the Democrats' decision to filibuster and McConnell's decision to employ the nuclear option. It means we could end up with a more conservative justice on the court down the road if Trump has a second opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And Todd, also the aspect here is that several of the justices currently on the court, Ginsburg, Kennedy, Breyer, are older, and they are not Scalia's. So if Donald Trump were to nominate a replacement for any of those or any, then that would be a point at which the court's balance would be changed, perhaps for a generation.
Yeah, and so in that sense, there's not nearly as much at stake in this current nomination. There's a lot at stake, don't get me wrong, about Judge Gorsuch's nomination, but there's not as much stake as there will be if one of those justices you listed is the next to leave the court. That will change. That will give the president the chance really to swing the balance. There aren't a large number of 5-4 rulings every year, but they tend to be in high-profile rulings. They're often in cases that are kind of morally charged or socially charged.
Roe v. Wade on abortion.
Sure. Whether to overturn Roe versus Wade at the time it was decided was not a close vote. But in the current era, kind of post-Roe, we have a lot of 5-4 cases on the abortion issue. So that and you know, same-sex marriage, any number, the individual mandate, which I mentioned a moment
ago. For health
ago.
Insurance.
Yeah, some of these cases that really capture the public's attention and are the focus of a lot of political debate. Citizens United, 5-4. So these cases that, whether you're law-trained or not, people are familiar with because they're so central to our culture, a lot of those are 5-4 rulings, and it's in those areas where the balance will change if there is another vacancy during President Trump's presidency.
Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Tony Goggin, a professor of law at Drake University. During our conversation, as we talk about the high court, we're going to move into talking about some of the more interesting cases before the court that are being heard or have been heard, have even been decided in just a moment. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Each of you have selected a few cases before the high court that you found interesting for one reason or another. Let me start with you, Tony. Give us a case that you think is currently before the court this session that we should be taking note of.
Sure. Ben, we had a big decision in evidence law in a case called Pena-Rodriguez v. Colorado. And it arises from what's called the no impeachment rule. And the basic rule in federal court is that once a jury reaches a verdict, we don't engage in a post-verdict inquiry into what went on during the jury deliberations. The basic idea here is we don't want jurors to be harassed after they hand down their verdict, and we want the jurors to be able to speak freely with each other during deliberations. There's been one longstanding exception to the rule, and that is if there is evidence after the verdict that there was some sort of improper outside influence, such as whether jurors were bribed or threatened or intimidated. But absent that kind of post-verdict evidence, we do not reinvestigate what happened during the jury deliberations. Well, Pena-Rodriguez has added a second major exception to this rule. In Pena-Rodriguez, the defendant was convicted of sexually assaulting two teenage sisters. After the verdict, two jurors told defense counsel that during deliberations, one of their fellow jurors said that the defendant was guilty because he was Mexican. And the juror also allegedly said that the defendant's alibi witness could not be trusted because he was an illegal immigrant. Now, as it happens, the witness was not an illegal immigrant. But in any case, the Supreme Court took this case, and in a 5-3 ruling, they reversed the defendant's conviction, and they held that if a juror makes a clear statement that he indicates he or she relied on racial stereotypes or animus to convict a criminal defendant, the Constitution requires that this longstanding no impeachment rule of the jury verdict give way in order to permit the trial court to consider the evidence of the juror's statement. So for criminal verdicts, this is a very important case because, of course, racism is a constant concern. We know it is present in unfortunately, in the criminal justice system. And this ruling will allow us now to investigate allegations of racism in juries that previously were not investigations that were not permitted. So this was a big case.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, it's hard to tell, but do you think a significant number of cases in the future will be affected by this decision? Or will perhaps the judges in these court cases give extra instruction to the jury to try to head off something like this?
You know, I think we will find out, Ben, because up until now, jury deliberations have been in what lawyers like to call black box, where these deliberations are held in secret. It's just for the jurors to speak freely with each other. Now that the door has been opened for counsel to inquire after the fact into whether or not racist views were expressed during those jury deliberations, I think we are going to see more motions, post-verdict motions, to inquire into the jury deliberations. And we will find out whether this is an issue that is broader than perhaps we previously thought. And in a diverse country like ours, obviously we cannot have systemic racism in our criminal justice system. And so I think the Supreme Court got this right, but we're going to see what the implications are as the lower courts apply it in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm. Todd Pettis, I wanted to move on to another case, Buck v. Davis, but I'm afraid we have just a couple minutes before our break. Perhaps you can set it up, tell us a little bit about the story, and we can tie up loose ends if need be after the break. But this is related to the case that Tony just mentioned somehow.
Yeah, it's another case that where someone is using race to predict someone's behavior. It's a very different person doing the predicting here. It's a psychologist, and it's a death penalty case having to do with a murder that happened in Houston. So maybe I'll just describe the crime. We'll see how far we get before your break. But more than two decades ago in Houston, a man named Dwayne Buck shows up at the home of his until recently then former girlfriend, Deborah Gardner. He's very angry. He thinks that she started a sexual relationship with another man who is also there. Dwayne Buck's own sister is at this home, as well as some children. He comes in armed. He finds his sister first. His sister pleads for her life, says, "I'm your sister. Remember, I have kids." He shoots her at point-blank range. Somehow she survives. He proceeds to the home. He finds the man that he thinks that his former girlfriend is having a relationship with, kills him, chases his former girlfriend out into the street. Her teenage children are there. They're all pleading for her life. The teenage daughter jumps on Dwayne Buck's back to persuade him not to kill. He kills her. He's convicted. He's going to be sentenced to death. And so when we come back after your break, we'll talk about what happened in the sentencing hearing and what the court said just about a month ago about
it. And ethnicity figuring into here, we'll talk about that when we come back with Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, Tony Goggin of Drake University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Also, when we come back, we'll talk about within the last few days, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional the standards used by the state of Texas to determine whether a convicted murderer is mentally deficient and thus may not be executed. That's one of the cases we have as we look over some of the interesting cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, also one before the Iowa Supreme Court on voter ID. Stay tuned. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with our legal minds here, our great legal minds, Tony Goggin of Drake University, also Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa. Every so often we like to look at what the U.S. Supreme Court or the Iowa Supreme Court are taking on as cases and what precedents may be set, and hearing the stories behind the cases and also the implications for the decisions that are made by our courts. And when we left before the break, we were right in the middle of a case. Todd was telling us about a case from Texas that looked at assessing the future danger of a murderer based on ethnicity. Pick that up.
Yeah, the case was Buck versus Davis. And so, as I said before the break, a man had killed his former girlfriend, and he's convicted of murder. And under Texas law at the time, in order to give him to sentence him to death, Texas had to show that he would probably commit violent crimes in the future. Texas has changed its law since then, but that was the legal standard at the time. You have to prove that this guy's going to be dangerous in the future. And if so, then you can execute him. And so they have a sentencing hearing to evaluate, try to predict the future for this guy. And a psychologist who was court appointed and did a lot of work for the Texas prison system named Walter Quijano, he had written a report. And in his report, he had evaluated this man, Dwayne Buck. And in his judgment, Dwayne Buck was not likely to be a risk in the future. But he also said in his report that the fact that he was male made it somewhat more likely that he'd be dangerous, and the fact that he was black made it more likely that he would be dangerous. Still, bottom line, he said, well, notwithstanding those things, I don't think Dwayne Buck himself is likely to be dangerous, but nevertheless, his race weighs against him. Dwayne Buck's own attorney calls this doctor to the stand, elicits this testimony about, you know, that he doesn't think that Dwayne Buck will be a danger in the future, but then for reasons that are really inexplicable, says, now, you know, you have some views about race, and it's your view that the fact that he's black makes it more likely that he'll be dangerous in the future. And the doctor says, yes, unfortunately, I think that's true. The state then, when it is cross-examining this guy, said, now, you said his race is going to weigh against him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so the jury deliberates for a couple days and comes back with the death penalty. This, as I said before the break, this is more than 20 years ago. There's all kinds of litigation that goes on through the state system and the federal system. In the late 1990s, in another case involving this same doctor, the United States Supreme Court said you can't use someone's race to predict their future dangerousness. And so in response to that, John Cornyn, who's senator from Texas now, but at the time he was the attorney general, they went back and evaluated how many people do we have on death row where this guy testified that their race weighed against them. And he identified about half a dozen cases. And in all those cases, the state said, we're going to have new sentencing hearings. These guys are all entitled to new sentencing, mm-hmm. but not Dwayne Buck. Because in Dwayne Buck's case, it was his own attorney who brought this evidence to the jury's attention. We, the state, weren't the ones who did it, and so we're going to make an exception in his case. The court ruled just about a month ago, they ruled 6-2, that these were extraordinary circumstances, which is a legal standard for reasons not worth going into detail on. But you have to show extraordinary circumstances to get this old case reopened and possibly get a new sentencing hearing. And a majority of the court, with Chief Justice Roberts writing the majority opinion, finds that there were extraordinary circumstances. I'll just mention, since we talked about Judge Gorsuch before and a little bit about what makes a conservative a conservative, it is Chief Justice Roberts writing this opinion, and he's joined by Justice Kennedy as well as the Democratic nominees. Justices Thomas and Alito dissented, and kind of the theory of their dissent, which is often what you see from some conservative judges, is this balance between yes, wanting to do justice in every case, but on the other hand, trying to respect the state's interest in finality. It costs money and it takes time to continually reexamine these cases that have been litigated before. And so for these two justices, the showing in this case wasn't sufficient to warrant reopening because there were other things that pointed to his possible future dangerousness at the time. He was – after he committed these murders, for example, he was laughing. He thought it was – seemed to think it was funny. He was relieved. He said that God had already forgiven him, that the woman – that these people had gotten what they deserved. And that is what the state predominantly relied on. The state hadn't jumped up and down and waved their hands saying, because he's black, he ought to be sentenced. But nevertheless, they did help put it in front of the jury. For a majority of the court, that he had a new sentencing hearing coming to him. For two justices, didn't quite reach the threshold.
Tony Goggin, let's turn to another case that you want to point out. This is a case, if we could go to the one that's happened in our neighboring state of Illinois. A man pulled over for a traffic stop, suspected of having illegal drugs.
Exactly right, Ben. This is the case of Manuel v. City of Joliet. And the date's very important. It happened shortly after midnight on March 18, 2011. And when the police officers pulled Mr. Manuel out of the vehicle, he testified that they uttered a racial slur and then conducted an illegal search of the vehicle. They found a vitamin bottle with pills inside the bottle. A field test came back negative for illegal drugs, but the police officers arrested Manuel anyway. Later, a laboratory test also came back negative. But inexplicably, the evidence technician falsely reported that one of the pills had tested positive for the illegal drug ecstasy. So Manuel was charged with possession of illegal narcotics, and a county court determined there was enough probable cause to keep him in jail. Manuel spent a total of 48 days behind bars in pretrial detention until he was finally released when the prosecutors belatedly responded to a state crime lab report that had found that there were no illegal drugs in the vitamin bottle. Well, Manuel, of course, filed suit eventually against the city of Joliet and the police. But the problem was he filed his suit on April 22, 2013. And the statute of limitations on civil rights claims of this type, Section 1983 claims under the Fourth Amendment, is 2 years.
So he was just a few days over that 2 years.
Exactly. 1 year or 1 month and 4 days too late. So the trial court dismissed his suit, but the Supreme Court disagreed. The Supreme Court held that his the accrual of his statute of limitations began not just on the day of his arrest, but during his pretrial detention. And this case shows how important statutes of limitations are. You cannot sit on your rights. You must bring suit in a timely fashion. And the reason for them is because we are concerned that evidence will grow stale over time and witnesses' memories may fade and evidence may be lost. So the date that the statute of limitations starts to run in any case is a crucial date. And that's true in civil cases as well as criminal.
Mm-hmm. Todd, take us back to another this is another death penalty case, actually also involving Texas, decided within the last few days, striking down and as unconstitutional, the U.S. Supreme Court did, standards used by Texas to determine whether a convicted murderer is mentally deficient and thus may not be executed. Tell us a little bit about this case and its significance.
Right. The case is Moore versus Texas. It was decided just on Tuesday of this week concerning another murder in Houston, coincidentally. And in this case, the murder happened during a very poorly executed robbery of a grocery store. And Bobby James Moore was had the gun in his hand. He said it went off by accident. Nevertheless, he's convicted of murder and then sentenced to death. That all happened way back in the early 1980s. Now, in 2002, these death penalty cases take so long, you know, just decades go by. In 2002, in a different case, the Supreme Court held that it would violate the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment says that the government can't cruelly and unusually punish you. In this 2002 case, the United States Supreme Court said it would violate that constitutional provision to execute someone who suffers from an intellectual disability because they're, you know, they're less culpable and don't deserve this most harsh of punishments. And so coming back closer to the current time, Bobby Moore seeks resentencing on grounds of intellectual disability. So his mental capacities become an issue. Okay. The Texas courts used factors called which Texas calls the Brezzano factors based on a case that they had previously decided. And these were factors that the court developed really in significant part based on the character Lenny Small in John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. And what the court said in this Brezzano case where they developed these factors for assessing someone's mental disability, the court said, well, you know, what our job here as a court is to figure out what would Texans regard as an intellectual disability sufficient to spare someone from the death penalty? And we could probably all agree here in Texas that Lenny Small in Of Mice and Men would not deserve the death penalty. And people, most people remember the storyline there. Lenny Small is this great big guy, clearly is not fully mentally developed and suffers from some problems. He kills someone accidentally. Okay, so commits a murder. So Texas court says, you know, someone like that, we wouldn't want to execute. But Texans also might say that just because someone meets the medical criteria, whatever the doctors say constitutes an intellectual disability, Texans might say, well, maybe the person deserves a death penalty, maybe they don't. So we need some other criteria beyond just what the doctors say. And so they came up with criteria, kind of looking at Lenny Small, like, you know, is someone capable of lying in order to protect their own interests? Is someone capable of planning? Can you execute a plan for the future? And in Bobby Moore's case, for example, he had lived on the street for a long time and managed to get by, figured out where food was, which shows at least some low-level intellectual functioning. They applied these, and so here in Bobby Moore's case, they use these Brezzano factors and say, even though he has an exceptionally low IQ score, somewhere between the high 60s or and the high 70s, which is very low, we don't think that he's intellectually disabled and it'd be okay to execute him. If you apply current medical standards, odds are quite good that he is, though, going to be judged intellectually disabled. No one has yet applied those standards in his case, so that's a bit of speculation. But that was the issue in front of the Supreme Court. Do you have to apply when you're assessing whether it violates the Eighth Amendment to execute someone? And if it does violate the Eighth Amendment, it's because they have an intellectual disability. How much do we have to follow the science? How much can we add to it? And the court said, a majority of the court, 5-3, the court said, you have to follow the science.
Mm-hmm.
The court here, the Texas court, did not rely on what doctors currently say, what clinicians currently say in well-regarded clinical manuals and so forth. And so they remanded the case. Now the Texas courts will take a look at it, applying these current criteria, and see whether this man suffers from an intellectual disability to such an extent that he cannot be executed.
Mm-hmm. Todd Pettis with us of the University of Iowa, Tony Goggin of Drake University. Final 10 minutes of our program as we look at some interesting cases before the high court. A couple I wanted to make sure we got to before we did have to end this hour. One that has, I believe, perhaps several cases, Tony, that have not been decided that have to do with politics, redistricting cases, dealing with gerrymandering, and this may have some great implications for the future of U.S. House and state legislative elections?
Ben, that's exactly right. The United States is very unusual among Western democracies in that we allow incumbent politicians to draw their own district lines. In fact, of the 50 states, 42 states allow partisan redistricting. Of course, here in Iowa, we don't. We are really a model of nonpartisan district line drawing. Well, in Wisconsin in 2011, the legislature adopted an extremely aggressive districting plan that had been guided through computer-assisted line drawing. And the result was the minority party, the Democrats, in order to win control of the legislature, would need to win a huge majority because the Republicans had done such a good job of drawing the lines in a way favorable to their candidates. Well, the Democrats brought suit, and in November of 2016, right after the presidential election, a federal court in Wisconsin found for the plaintiffs. And why this case is so interesting is because since the 1980s, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that partisan gerrymandering, which is the term for politically motivated redistricting, the Supreme Court has held that partisan gerrymandering may violate the Constitution of the United States under the 14th Amendment and even potentially the First Amendment. But the Supreme Court has never been able to come up with a standard to decide these cases, to figure out when is the gerrymandering too extreme. And in the case in Wisconsin that was decided in November, the plaintiffs offered a theory that was developed by a law professor at the University of Chicago, which is called the efficiency gap. And what it does is it looks at how many of the minority party's votes are wasted. And that is very attractive for courts because it gives them a number. In this case, 8% is the threshold. If there's an 8% gap between the number of votes wasted by the minority party because of partisan gerrymandering, that's an excessive gerrymander, and that constitutes a constitutional violation. Well, the state of Wisconsin appealed their defeat, and there's a very good chance the U.S. Supreme Court will hear this case in the fall of 2017. And this case is unfolding at the same time that former President Obama has announced that his primary post-presidential task will be to fight partisan gerrymandering. So this is an issue that's got obviously very significant political ramifications, but now it potentially has significant constitutional ramifications. So I suspect this is a case that Todd and I will be discussing on your program next fall.
Interesting. And it is interesting when you bring up in a past election, perhaps you have numbers on this, when we look at the number of votes cast for, say, Democratic House candidates versus Republican House candidates, you would think it would break down more or less to divide into the seats, be representative. We are in a representative democracy, but it's not representative, is it?
Ben, that's exactly right. Here's an example. The Wisconsin apportionment in partisan gerrymandering in 2011 was also occurring in the other 49 states. And as a result of that, because Republicans had done so well in the midterm elections in 2010, they controlled most states' redistricting process. And as a result, in the 2012 congressional elections, Democratic candidates actually received over a million more votes than Republican candidates did overall around the country. And yet Republicans emerged from the House elections in 2012 with a 30-seat majority. And we even saw it in 2016. Republicans won a majority, or they won a plurality of the popular vote in 2016, but their margin was only about 1%. It was a 49-48% breakdown nationwide in the U.S. House elections. And yet Republicans won 55% of the seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So gerrymandering is certainly something that has tremendous political ramifications, especially when the country is already self-sorting. Republicans and Democrats, as a number of studies by political scientists have shown, tend to like to live next to each other. And that really makes the gerrymandering job easier. And so the fact that this issue is now potentially on the Supreme Court's radar is very important.
Mm-hmm. In the remaining 2 or 3 minutes that we have, I'd like to have a quick word from you, Tony, perhaps you, Todd, as well, on an Iowa Supreme Court case having to do with a newly passed voter ID law. I guess so. The constitutionality of Iowa's pending. I don't think it's not law yet. The new voter ID law. What parts of the law are under legal scrutiny, Tony?
Right. So, Ben, you're right. The Iowa legislature hasn't yet enacted the new voter ID law, although it's certainly expected to do so. And what's interesting about it is this law is being adopted in the shadow of a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2008 called Crawford v. Marion County, in which the U.S. Supreme Court upheld photo IDs, a photo ID requirement in order to register and vote. And the Iowa legislation is very controversial, but what's noteworthy about it is, although it's a voter ID law, it does not include a photo ID requirement. And it seems very likely, therefore, that this law, though controversial, will withstand constitutional scrutiny, certainly under the federal constitution.
What difference does the photo precedent. What difference does the photo make?
The difference the photo makes is courts last year in both North Carolina and Texas, conservative courts, found that photo ID laws disproportionately burden poorer voters and minority voters who are less likely to have a government-issued photo ID. And so there is in the last year some movement against photo ID requirements and voter ID laws in different judicial circuits. So the fact that the Iowa law is drafted in such a way that doesn't require a photo and it, at least under the current version of the bill, provides for an automatic government-issued ID. It doesn't have a photo on it, but the Secretary of State's office is under the plan is issuing a voter registration ID card to every voter free of charge automatically, likely means that it will withstand legal scrutiny if and when a case is brought challenging the law.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it makes sense that lawmakers crafting such legislation really check about precedent and what's been happening in other states. And do you know, Tony, that they have in this case, that they've crafted it in such a way that it has a good chance of being upheld should it be challenged in court?
I think so. The fact that this law is distinguishable from what we've seen in other states recently suggests that it was drafted with pre-existing court precedent in mind.
Mm-hmm. So with the remaining minute that we have, let's go back to Neil Gorsuch. Perhaps in as little as just over a week's time, he will be occupying that long vacant ninth seat in the high court. We're predicting that will take place, Todd. When you look at what's happening in the Senate,
there's nothing at all to indicate that he won't be confirmed. In other words, if you don't want Judge Gorsuch on the court, you really don't have anything to look to as a source of hope. If you do want him on the court, you ought to be very, very pleased because he's either going to get on because they have enough votes to end debate and to kill a filibuster, or they're going to kill the filibuster, and it's clear that they're going to do that, just as the Democrats, by the way, killed the filibuster during President Obama's presidency for lower-level judicial appointees and for executive appointees. So by virtue of both parties' actions, the filibuster probably is going to be gone in about a week.
Mm-hmm. Very, very quickly, does Neil Gorsuch, if he goes to the high court, does he start immediately? Does he get a month to relax?
I think he can move there as quickly as he can. He'll bring some very lucky law clerks, some recent law school grads with him who thought they were going to be working in Colorado. It turns out they're going to be in Washington, D.C., working on the Supreme Court.
Very good. Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa. Tony Goggin, Professor of Law at Drake University. Always a pleasure, gentlemen, to have your expertise as we look at goings-on in the high court. Thank you, Tony and Todd.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Tune in again tomorrow. Already Friday. That means it's a News Buzz edition tomorrow. Hope you'll tune in. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.